Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm while she's away on vacation. She'll be back on Monday. Chris Bohjalian says he never wants to write the same book twice, and it appears he's succeeding at that goal. The best-selling author of Midwives has written about the accidental shooting of an animal rights activist, interracial adoption, and a love story set in World War II Poland. His latest novel takes on two new subjects, post-traumatic stress disorder and herbalism. The book, his first ghost story, is titled The Night Strangers, and author Chris Bohjalian joins me from WBEZ in Chicago. Chris, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
I know you have a lot of fans out there who've read Midwives and some of Chris's other books, Secrets of Eden, so give us a call. This is a chance to talk to him about this book, the new one, as well as some of his other works. 1-800-433-8850 is our number. drshow@wamu.org is our email address, and of course, you can do Facebook, Twitter, and carrier pigeon, however you want to communicate with us. Chris, why a ghost story?
Oh, you know, I think all of us have a certain affection for ghost stories, the way they get the adrenaline pumping, the way they get the endorphins going. And certainly I have an affection for ghost stories. One of the only books from my childhood I still own is a 45-cent Washington Square paperback of Edgar Allan Poe's collected works. I actually pulled it down from a bookcase about 2 months ago, and I was delighted to find two things. First of all, I had written big stars and underlines all over the cask of Amontillado, and my penmanship was every bit as bad in third and fourth grade as my mother always said it was.
What is it about ghost stories? You say it gets the endorphins going. You think it's the appeal. You write kind of darkly that a lot of it has to do with the fear of death and calling up those very deep and dark feelings we all have on some level.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's correct, Steve. To a certain extent, the ghost story plumbs that great subterranean part of our minds, our unconscious. It plumbs our fears of death. And at the same time, ghost stories, I think, strangely fan our hopes that when the casket is shut or when the body goes into the crematorium, the show isn't necessarily over. For a book like The Night Strangers, inadvertently, I think I tap into that because so much of the book is set underground, literally underground, when this commercial airline pilot who's had this disastrous water ditching with three-quarters of his passengers dying finds a door in his basement that's nailed shut. And by design, all of those scenes, I hope, are vaguely reminiscent of the idea of opening a crypt or opening a mausoleum.
You say that in one of the interviews I read that I creeped myself out when you wrote this book. Is that how you want readers to read it? Do you want them to be creeped out?
I've got a really creepy basement. First of all, I need to tell you that I am the world's most inept handy person. What my wife and I were doing buying this 1898 Victorian is unfathomable to me. But
in rural Vermont.
In rural Vermont, yeah. We moved there from Brooklyn. But about 3 days after we moved into the house, I was carrying a load of laundry downstairs, and I noticed in our basement this door. I'd never noticed it before because I was so fixated on the mud floor basement. So I put down the laundry and go to the door, and it's nailed shut. Literally nailed shut. I, to this day, I presume it was just a coal chute. But it would nevertheless be 3 years before I would finally man up and get the crowbar and the axe and the pliers and pull the door open. And behind it, I found nothing. Absolutely nothing. Behind that door were these thick beams walling up the dirt in the foundation.
Not even one or two bones, not a shroud, no, nothing.
No,
what a disappointment.
I'm happy to report also that when I went upstairs, the dining room walls had not started to bleed. But I was still deeply disturbed by the fact that for whatever the reasons, one of the previous owners of this house had created this 18-inch deep compartment and then nailed the door shut. So I put the door back in place, and indeed I did hammer the nails back in place. And ever since then, I had the sense that this was an entry to a novel. I just didn't know what the story was going to be. And as a result, to this day, I find the basement a little unnerving. Since writing The Night Strangers, I've made sure never to go down there at night. I you know, it's nice to discover.
This is an excuse. This is clearly an excuse not to do the laundry anymore, right?
I just do the laundry in daylight. But you know, it really has brought back all of my 8 and 9 year old boy fears of chiller theater. My daughter is 17, and her response after reading the book is she doesn't even want to go into our basement at daylight.
Well, you talk very vividly. And in fact, the first page of the book describes this scene, which, as you point out, is taken largely from life. But the other event, the other real life inspiration for this book, as you alluded to, was the famous ditching of an airliner in the Hudson River by the well-celebrated pilot Sully Sullenberger. He was able to save all of his passengers, but the core of the story, the instigation for the story, or one of them, is that the character in your book, Chip Linton, fails to do what Sullenberger did.
Yep. Yeah, when I found that door in my basement, I honestly knew that someday that was going to be an opening to a novel, but I wouldn't figure out what the novel was until January 15th, 2009, when, like millions and millions of people around the world, I watched transfixed, or I listened transfixed, to the evacuation of Flight 1549, the Airbus in the Hudson River, Chesley Sullenberger's Miracle on the Hudson. And it might have been the shape of the overwing exit doors, but I thought of the door in my basement, and I began to wonder, what would it be like in a post-Sully Sullenberger world to go through life as the pilot who wasn't Sully? The pilot who had to ditch his commercial jet and in cartwheels or at pinwheels and people die, but the pilot lives. What kind of ghosts would dog him? What kind of post-traumatic stress disorder would be with him for forever, perhaps? And that was the book that I originally expected to write. When I started this book, I imagined that all the ghosts would be metaphoric. I was perhaps a third of the way into the novel before the ghosts became literal and real.
Chris Bojelian's new book is called The Night Strangers. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today, and we're talking about his latest book and how it came about, and we have some lines open, so give us a call, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, and share some of your ghost stories, some of your places, secret places that resonate in your imagination and in your life. But Chris, one of the things that is you did in researching this book was go to a flight simulator in Connecticut and try to capture the experience of what it would be like to be in that plane when it capsized on Lake Champlain in your story, or in the Hudson in the real life version. Talk about why you did that and what it felt like and how that infused your sensibility to write that scene.
Sure. For The Night Strangers, as with all of my books, I do a lot of research. I interviewed shamans, herbalists, pilots, lots and lots of pilots. But one of the things that no one could really tell me is, what does it feel like to be in a passenger jet upside down that's starting to sink? There aren't a lot of people you can interview about that. But I remember that great 1982 movie, An Officer and a Gentleman, with Lou Gossett and Deborah Winger and Richard Gere, and the dunk tank. Richard Gere gets into that egg and is dropped into the swimming pool. And I thought to myself, you've got to go in the dunk tank. Well, the dunk tank has come so far since then. Imagine a cutaway of an airplane fuselage that dangles above a 100,000-gallon tank of water. And this 35 or 40-foot-long simulator can be dropped into the tank, rolled upside down. It can be set on fire as it's dropped into the tank, because sometimes when a helicopter or a plane's going down, there is smoke and flame. And I spent the day in the simulator getting wet, largely with 3 National Guard aviators. And I wanted to do this because I wanted to understand, what is it like? I knew it would be scary. I understood that. But I wanted to know the more prosaic details that might bring the plane crash scene to life. And I learned an enormous amount, especially in the final drop we did. They configured the simulator to be a regional jet with a flight deck. And they put me in the flight deck as Captain Chip Linton with a five-point pilot's shoulder harness, the yoke in front of me, the flight deck door behind me, drop it into the tank, roll it 180 degrees so it's up, so I'm completely upside down, strapped in underwater. And they gave me 28 seconds to get away from the yoke, undo my five-point harness, open the flight deck door upside down, swim into the passenger cabin, find the emergency exit door, open it, and swim to the surface. And I learned all of these small details that I hadn't anticipated that are so important to make a book feel authentic. Everything from the monumental burning snootfuls of water you get because you're not holding your nose and you're upside down and you're so focused on tactics in your hands and doing things. Secondly, I was unprepared for how heavy my clothes would be or how much water would be in my shoes. And even though I had been so coached by the folks at Survival Systems, the sense of panic, to wit, they warned me that in a five-point shoulder harness, you need to spin it 360 degrees around your chest so that all of the belts around your legs and your arms and shoulders fly away. They told me very specifically, you're going to be so scared upside down in this confined space that you're only going to spin at 345 degrees, perhaps, or 300 degrees, and one of the straps is going to be holding you in.
Hold that thought. We'll find out whether he actually got out of the harness, and in fact, he is talking to us live, or whether he's one of his own dead characters. Chris Bohjalian, his new book is The Night Strangers. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour, Chris Bohjalian, best-selling author of books like Midwives and Secrets of Eden. His new book, The Night Strangers, his first ghost story. He's on the line with me from Chicago. And Chris, you were, before the break, you were telling us how difficult and how petrifying, really, this experience was. But you did get out.
I did. I did indeed. But exactly like the scuba divers had warned me, with a five-point shoulder harness, I would be so nervous underwater that I would spin it insufficiently far. And so sure enough, I started to try to swim from my seat underwater, and one of my legs was still in the harness. And I did have that moment of panic that, oh, my God, you're not going to get out of here alive. You're going to be the first person to ever die in the simulator. But then I remembered, wait a minute, just spin it again. They warned you, just spin it again. And sure enough, my leg came free, and I was able to swim to the door.
Now, this, you are able to experience this very scary and important moment in the book. But then, as you point out earlier, the book evolved from your first conception of it, and that ghosts that were once metaphorical became real characters in the book. Now, presumably you didn't have the ability to experience what it's like to be dead. So how did you craft those characters?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. In some ways, the most difficult part of writing this book was trying to create dead characters that were every bit as vibrant and vital and interesting and authentic as the live ones. And that meant trying to understand the full backstories of the characters in the book mm-hmm. who are dead. Mm-hmm. And not simply their backstories when they're living, but, for example, why are they present for Chip but not necessarily for other people in the house. Why are they present for Chip at certain points? And what
Chip, of course, is Chip the pilot, just to remind our listeners. Go ahead.
Yep. And what Captain Chip Linton presumes are tangible manifestations of these ghosts. Are they indeed tangible manifestations, or is it just a further indication of Chip's spiraling descent into madness? This is a guy who, prior to this water ditching, had really had the right stuff. And now, as his wife Emily has observed, he's just a shell of the man that he was, as he focuses relentlessly on remorse, regret, and what-ifs.
One of the other dimensions of this book and characters in this book are Chip's twin daughters. And you have previously written about twins in a variety of ways. Now, I'm a twin. I have twin nieces and I have twin grandsons who happen to be the same age as the twin daughters in your book, 10 years old. Wow. What is it about twins that you find so compelling, almost mystical?
Well, first of all, did I get anything right about the twins, Steve, to be honest?
As long as you, as I will just simply tell you one line from my twin grandsons, when one of them got a bunch of stitches and the other one said, "How many did you get?" And the guy said, you know, first one said maybe six or seven. And the first twin said, "Yes, I'm still ahead." And I said, "Boys, this is not a competition." And they said to me in unison, "Everything is a competition." So if you got that part of it, you got it right.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate that. You're right. This is not the first time that twins have appeared in my fiction. Most notably, in The Buffalo Soldier, there are twin girls who perish in the prologue in the sort of violent, unexpected flash flood in Vermont that, as a state, tragically, we just experienced on the very last day in August when Tropical Storm Irene thundered into the Green Mountains. I'm not honestly sure why I am so drawn to twins in fiction, but I know that I've read a lot of novels where twins have just found, I've just found the twins relentlessly interesting, most recently perhaps Audrey Niffinger's Her Fearful Symmetry. And the thing that mattered to me in this book about the twins wasn't necessarily that they were twins, but that they were close in age, they were going to be spending a lot of time with each other, and I'm not revealing anything about the ending of this book, but clearly the twins are going to be in a certain amount of jeopardy as the novel progresses, and I wanted readers to have a sense of fear and anxiety about them, and specifically wonder, is one more in danger than the other?
Well, I won't reveal the ending either. But, you know, a lot of critics, Chris, at least some that I've read, have used the word sinister to describe this book and said, and compare it to some of your other books and say it's more, there is this level of dread that you just described that is a departure for you. Do you agree with that description?
I do. I certainly think this is a scarier book than any of my other books. It's certainly a more sinister book. But I think it's also, for those reasons, in some ways a lot of fun. Once this book became a ghost story, and once it wasn't simply focused on the tragedy of this one good person, I think the book became a lot more of a page-turner because suddenly you're not sloughing through the mud of despair. You're hopefully rifling through the pages to wonder what's going to happen to Emily and to Chip and to these twin girls. I will say that I think the darkest book I've ever written is not The Night Strangers, but Skeletons at the Feast, which is a love story set in the last 6 months of World War II in the cauldron and the Holocaust of Poland and Germany, the most nightmarish 6 months in human history. Now that is a legitimately dark book.
Chris, there's a lot of your readers who want to join us, and I particularly want to go to Beth here in Washington, who has a very personal connection to your story. So Beth, please, thank you so much for joining us, and go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Steve, and good morning, Chris.
Hello, Beth.
I am so overwhelmed by listening to you talk about how you decided to write this book. The first question I have, actually, is did you actually get to talk to Captain Sullenberger about his experience so that you could write about the other side of it where this pilot didn't save his passengers?
Sure. No, I never interviewed Captain Sullenberger. I wish I had, not necessarily for this book, but just because I loved his memoir, Highest Duty. What a great guy he clearly is. What a terrific pilot he is. But I think it's that first part, what a terrific guy he is, that so interests me. He tells some stories in Highest Duty about how he never wanted to be a bystander, and in some cases that simply meant finding for a young couple their infant car seat, which had been checked when they boarded the plane, and now it's disappeared, and U.S. Airways baggage is closed, and he did not go home until he'd found them their car seat. I mean, clearly he's a great, great guy.
I will tell you from knowing him now that he is one
you
of
should,
the
you should, excuse
men
me,
you'll ever meet.
Excuse me, you should tell our listeners that you were a passenger on that flight.
Yes.
Okay.
I am so intrigued.
Beth, it's wonderful to hear from you.
I was driving along the highway. I had to get off of the highway because I could feel when you started talking about the water and being turned upside down in the water, and I was never upside down in the water, but I could feel that terror as you were talking about it. I could feel it all over again, and so I had to get off the highway and make a call to tell you how much your words just struck me right away. But
your words have struck me too, and I'm so thrilled that you've called in because it means you're alive. It's great to hear from you, Beth. My gosh.
Oh yes, we're all alive, and we're very much alive, and we love the fact that we are.
Yep,
and
me too.
We all have gotten to know a little bit about Sully, and most of us have gotten to meet him personally, and he is one of the finest men you'll ever meet.
But that's my sense.
Aside from that, is also the co-pilot, Jeff Skiles, is one of the finest men you will ever meet. And we love that we know them. We love that they saved our lives that day, of course. But now that you're writing this story, I'm just so intrigued by your comments about how you wanted to write the story like this and how you went about doing that test. That's amazing to me that you went that far into the characterization of it that you would do that kind of a test.
Okay, thank you so much, Beth. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Beth.
You know, one of the things that her description of Sullenberger and your own description in his book, what you've tried to do is take that sense of a good man, as Sullenberger clearly is, and turn it upside down. And what happens, as you say, when it's not a heroic ending but a tragic ending? And that's really the crux of of the book in some ways.
It is, and it's a tragic ending in my novel through no fault of Captain Chip Linton. He has a 70-seat regional jet. He's bearing down on Lake Champlain. He's profoundly familiar with what Captain Sullenberger accomplished and how the emergency checklist has even changed in the wake of Flight 1549. And it looks like it's going to be perfect. He's going to get everyone out alive on the waters of Lake Champlain when one of the ferry boats that link New York State and Vermont is turning to rescue this flight that is veering into the water, and the low wingtip of the regional jet is caught in the wake of the wave, and suddenly it's pitch-poling, and there was nothing that Captain Chip Linton could have done differently, but he's never going to forgive himself. Never, never, never.
Let's talk to, I hope I have your name correctly, Oda Alice in Eustis, Florida.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Welcome.
Oh, Dallas.
Okay, thank you so much.
I just wanted to make a comment because I listen to the show every day during lunch, and I have not read any of your books, but I'm extremely intrigued in reading this one. And your story of the basement really brought back some extremely strong memories that I had as a child. Going down, I grew up right in New Jersey, right by the Hudson River where that flight situation took place. And
so did I. What town did you grow up in?
I grew up in West New York.
All right. I grew up in Bayonne. It's just a few miles from New York. I know what you're talking about. Go ahead.
Exactly. Well, I just wanted to say how powerful a child's imagination can be, because I would literally go down to that dark, dingy basement, and to this day, you brought back the memories of the mustiness, the smell. I would literally get myself to believe that as I went up the steps and down the steps that were only, you know, the wooden planks, that there were hands that were going to grab my legs. And to this
yep,
day,
I know that feeling.
Yes, I fear scary movies.
Did you run up the basement steps, O'Dallas?
Yes, I would run up and would run down, and I could see the little glimmers of light coming through, you know, the windows. But it's amazing how powerful what you were saying just brought back all those memories, and how I don't know if it's because of those memories and those experiences as a child that to this day I stay away from anything scary. But I am going to pick up your book, and I think
thank
I'm really
you so much.
Going to enjoy it. So thank you so much
O'Dallas.
For sharing with us.
Thanks.
You bet.
Thanks for the call. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Those fears and those feelings that she expresses, very common in childhood. Do your own kids, you mentioned your own kids feel that way about your own basement?
Yeah, my daughter's absolutely terrified of our basement now. And it's not just because she doesn't want to do the laundry. I mean that. But I was really glad O'Dallas called because it reminded me of some of the scenes in the book that I found most interesting to write. And those are scenes involving the twin girls, Haley and Garnet. They're 10 years old. And I tried to recall my own visceral fears when I was 10 years old and the things that went bump in the night that would leave me scared. And then now I've dropped these two 10-year-old girls into an 1898 three-story in Victorian house, and a house that will turn out to have, yes, a history, strange corridors, ridiculously terrifying wallpaper, and, yes, the basement. And so to a certain extent, I'm hoping this is also a book about all of the things that scared us as kids.
Right. Well, I think this is almost universal. I remember growing up just a few miles from where O'Dallas was, and the basement had coal bins, and because that's where we heated the house in those days, was through coal furnaces. And almost by definition, the darkness and the blackness of the coal was part of what just coated everything, literally and metaphorically.
Indeed. Indeed. It's almost Dickinsonian.
Oh, absolutely. Let's turn to some other callers who want to share their own stories with us. Shauna in Guilford, Connecticut. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you so much. And Chris, I've read many of your books, and I love them so much.
Thanks, Shauna. We also bought
our own 1890s Victorian here on the Connecticut shoreline, and we moved in, and on our first block party, all our neighbors came up to us and asked us if we'd seen our ghost yet. And indeed, my daughter ended up seeing him. He's an old sea captain, you know, benign guy. And I started looking immediately into getting rid of him. And my husband and I had a big argument because my husband wanted to keep him. And so it was funny because we had this argument about whether or not to keep our ghost. So that's our...
Remember the ghost and Mrs. Muir?
Excuse me?
Do you remember the ghost and Mrs. Muir?
No, sea I captain, don't.
Ghostly sea captain. Mrs. Muir has the house with a ghostly sea captain who is not merely benign presence in the strange world of 1960s television. I think he's almost a person of romantic possibilities.
Well, I don't know if he's still around, but several people have lived in this house, and they also come by and tell us about the sea captain. So thank you so much.
Well, just a minute. You never told us what you did.
Well, I looked into, I never knew this term, smudging him out. And I went around. This is so embarrassing. I went around.
That's all right. You're among friends. No one's listening.
And you take this sort of herb and you burn it. Make sure you don't burn down your house. But the smoke, I guess, you go into every corner of your house, and it smells exactly like pot.
You will learn the details of that herb in The Night Strangers.
And you say, sounding totally ridiculous to yourself, move on towards the light. You can go. We love this house. You can go. And I am convinced that he has gone over to the other side.
Good work.
So that's my story.
Now, Chris, you say that you have an herb, you know what the herb she's talking about, and it plays a role in your book.
I do. Among the other characters in this novel, we focused a lot on the plane crash, but the plane crash figures predominantly in the prologue. The lion's share of the book is set in this creepy backwater New Hampshire town deep in the White Mountains, and Chip and Emily Linton arrive there and are astounded at the number of greenhouses and how all of their neighbors have these unbelievable green thumbs, but not necessarily for tomatoes and peas and phlox and daisies and roses, but for herbs with unpronounceable names that seem to have been brought to New Hampshire from India and Africa and South America. And as the book unfolds, you will learn more about them.
And we will learn more about the book. We will learn more about your phone calls and your own ghost stories when we come back. So stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. And by Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to keep photos, music, and other files safe from computer mishaps. Details at carbonite.com. This is NPR.
Under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Air Force Lieutenant Josh Seyfried started a secret Facebook group for gay and lesbian soldiers called OutServe. Now Lieutenant Seyfried is out, and so is his boyfriend, Air Force pilot Lieutenant Carl Johnson, who has been blogging for Time magazine as Officer X. Seyfried and Johnson join us on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour, Chris Bohjalian, author of many novels, including several New York Times bestsellers, Midwives, Secrets of Eden, Skeletons at the Feast. His new book is The Night Strangers, and Chris and I have been talking about it, and this is his first ghost story, but several of you have been calling in to share your own ghost stories, and I will now turn to Chris, to several of our other callers who want to join this. And Ben in Columbus, Ohio, has been waiting patiently. Thanks for joining us. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Steve.
Hi, Ben.
One of my really the question that I had for you, Chris, and this is, so I am the earnestness of full disclosure, I am actually a mathematician. I don't get the joy of writing a lot, but I do enjoy writing, and it's been something that I've done since I was younger, just to use my imagination and have a healthy outlet for it. But something that I've noticed that I do is that even if I feel like I've read the story before, or I feel like I've seen it on TV or something, if there's a story that I just cannot get out of my mind, I have to write it. And if I don't write it, if I try to say, well, it's already been done, you know, it sticks with me and it won't let me go. And I feel like even, you know, if I was in your position as an author, sometimes I would wonder, you know, should I instead spend the time writing a new story, writing something novel in the sense that is new. And I just wonder, do you ever find yourself with a story that you just feel like you can't get out of your head, but you know it's already been told? And what do you do? How do you cope with that? How do you handle that internal conflict between writing something new and writing something that you have to get out?
Thanks, Ben.
You know, Scott Fitzgerald used to talk about the dead end and how very often he wouldn't know whether a story was worth pursuing or a novel was worth pursuing until he'd written part of it, and that his scrapbooks were filled with what he called the dead ends. And in some cases, they were dead ends because it was a failed effort. It wasn't the book or the short story that he was destined to write, or he couldn't get his arms around the material in quite the right fashion. And in some cases, they were dead ends because, precisely as you suggested, Ben, someone else had already done it, or somebody had done it better. Certainly in my case, I've started to write books, and then in my research discovered that, gosh, somebody else has already written a book like this, and it's better. Or, and Ann Patchett talked about this movingly once in a New York Times essay, you get halfway through a book and you realize, I'm not capable of writing this book. I'm not good enough. This isn't the great American novel. And so then you just slog your way to the end to get a first draft and hope in subsequent drafts you can salvage it. As Gabriel Garcia Marquez once said, the only reason writers publish is to stop rewriting.
But it's also true, and I teach young writers and nonfiction, but a lot of the same issues come up, that you can't flinch from familiar stories. In some ways, I tell them there are stories that are great because they hardly ever happen, and then there are stories that are great because they happen every day. And that just because a story is familiar doesn't mean it can't be a great story.
No, I think that's so well put. How many times have we discovered Romeo and Juliet in yet another form? Or, and you know, many of my novels have a template. A book that I read that I absolutely loved, and the structure was perfect for what I wanted to do, and I've thought of that book as I was writing my book. So, for example, Kent Hariff's Plain Song is the template for The Buffalo Soldier. Mm-hmm. Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird was the template for Midwives, a first-person female narrator in her late 20s or early 30s, looking back on a seminal event in her childhood that changed everything for her, her discovery of that the world is not necessarily a just place, that adults are not always kind and good and smart.
Good points. Let's turn to more of our callers. Pete in Fern Park, Florida. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show with Chris Bojalian.
Hi. I don't know. Your story here says all the passengers died and the pilot survived. Did I understand it correct?
No, that's not correct. Three-quarters of the passengers die.
Anyway, sometime in the late 50s, there was a mid-air collision over New York State between a four-engine propeller-driven aircraft and an early 707. The 707 sheared off the entire tail section of the propeller-driven aircraft. Then the 707 was able to make a safe landing. Propeller-driven aircraft without a tail can't steer very well, but the pilot did have all four engines, and as a result of those, he was able to bring that airplane down in a controlled level flight as it crash landed in a field. As the increased speed, the plane would pitch up, decrease the propeller noise, the propellers, it would pitch down. You know, he could turn it left or right. He was able to bring it into a flat crash landing in a field. The only person that died was the pilot.
Wow. That's pretty wrenching and pretty heroic of him to do that. Thank you for sharing that story. I'm familiar with a lot of aviation disasters, but that's one I had never heard.
Thanks for calling, Pete. We appreciate it very much. Let's turn to Jim in Dallas, Texas. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Oh, thanks very much. I had a little off-counter question here. You talk about using twins, and I think that novelists are predominantly obsessed with distilling their story, and I think that twins the use of twins, it helps them to just double down on that type of distillation, if you understand what I, you know. And that's just my observation, but I think it's a truly bona fide way to do it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Jim. In how many novels have you used twins?
You know, I believe it's three. I was thinking about this. The two books that were twins figure most prominently are certainly The Buffalo Soldier and The Night Strangers. And I think it's interesting to note that in both cases they're twin girls, and in both cases they're in the fourth or the fifth grade. I remember when my wife was pregnant with our daughter. We have one girl, one child. We used to talk about, wouldn't it be great if you had twins and we would instantly have a nuclear family of four? I remember about 2 months after our daughter Grace had arrived, my wife and I were standing in our kitchen surveying the utter chaos and the madness and the debris and the plates that are the size of skyscrapers in the sink. And we both said, wow, anyone who has twins, any parents who have twins are just freaking amazing to pull this off and keep their sanity.
Well, I'll tell you what my mother said when who, since it was 1943 during the war and pre all the technologies, which now can tell you so much more than you could then. She had no idea she was having twins. And when she woke up from the anesthetic and they said, by the way, Mrs. Roberts, you have two. She said, oh, my God, that's a lot of baby, and went back to sleep. It was. Then my brother was quite small, and he was in the hospital for a while. And, you know, it was an impulse to say, well, keep him for a couple of years. You know, I mean, as you say, one is enough. It's a great way to grow up, I can tell you. I treasure being a twin, and I love having twin grandsons. But I want to ask you a bit about your own background, because people will see your name, Bojalian, and those who know about such things know it's of Armenian ancestry, and that while you grew up in New York, your next book reaches back to your own Armenian history for part of the inspiration. Why don't you talk about that?
Sure. My next novel is called The Sandcastle Girls, and it's a bit like Skeletons at the Feast in that it's a big, sweeping, epic, historical love story. In this case, however, it is set in 1915, largely in Aleppo, Syria, though also in Turkey, Armenia, and the Battle of Gallipoli. It's a love story between a new graduate of Mount Holyoke College who follows her father into the cauldron of the Armenian genocide and there falls in love with a young widower named Armen, who has lost his family in the Armenian genocide. About 1.5 million of the 2 million Armenians living in Turkey died in the First World War, or 3 out of 4, which seemed a statistic too personal not to examine it. And here's why I say too personal. Because of my 4 paternal Armenian great-grandparents, 3 would die in that cauldron between 1915 and 1917.
And have you always wanted to write about that period and that dimension of your own ancestry?
No. Hmm. No. I had actually envisioned that I might go through life and never examine it. But then when my father's health started deteriorating a few years ago, we would be looking through the photographs of his parents, and I would look at the photographs of them taken in 1927 when they first arrived at Ellis Island in 1928, and I thought back on how my Swedish mother used to refer to her in-law's house in Tuckahoe, New York, as the Ottoman Annex of the Metropolitan, because it really was so oddly Armenian. And I started talking to my father about his childhood and the reality that until he was 5 years old, he spoke only Armenian and Turkish. When he started public kindergarten in Tuckahoe, New York, he didn't know how to ask where the bathroom was. And it dawned on me that this is a story that needs to be probed. And so The Sandcastle Girls goes back and forth in time between a woman novelist in the present, a stand-in for me, and the fictional love story of her grandparents in the midst of the Armenian genocide.
Of course, the Armenian culture, a very literate one, and there have been a number of Armenian or authors of Armenian descent, Michael Arlen with the Green Hat, the wonderful book Black Dog of Fate.
There have been Peter Balakian.
Some wonderful nonfiction books about that period. But you are, being a novelist, you're taking a novelist's view of it and not a literal one.
And there was one, yes, you're right. First of all, yes, I think Peter Balakian has written, aside from being a magnificent poet, I think he has written the most important memoir there could possibly be for our generation of Armenian Americans, and that is Black Dog of Fate.
It's a great book. I agree with you.
It's just his childhood in so many ways paralleled mine. Sort of the great Armenian novel, the novel The Armenian Genocide, though, is The 40 Days of Musadeh, written by Franz Werfel in 1934. I read that book earlier this year, and it is like Tolstoy. It's riveting, it's big, it's epic, and alas, it is out of print. The edition I read is a 1934 cloth-bound edition that is discolored with age and absolutely, absolutely magnificent. And here's one interesting footnote to the Armenian genocide. When the Nazis were finally destroying the Warsaw Ghetto once and for all, they were astonished to find so many copies of the 40 Days of Musadeh. Why? Because the Jewish resistors, the Jewish fighters, were viewing that novel as sort of their rallying cry in some cases, because as Gabriel says in the 40 Days of Musadeh, it is best to die like a lion.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, to reinforce that point, Chris, as you know, throughout the Ottoman Empire, your Swedish mother, referring to the Ottoman outpost of your grandparents' house, throughout the Ottoman Empire, Jews and Armenians played very similar roles. They were, along with Greeks, they were the commercial class. Even today in Istanbul, they've shrunk, but there were at one time vibrant Jewish and Armenian and Greek communities, and they often were the merchants and the traders. Throughout the Ottoman Empire. So historically, Jews and Armenians had that parallel as well.
And among the delightful, wonderful We Are the World footnotes to my own childhood and my own adolescence is the first girl I ever seriously kissed and had a serious teen crush on. She was Turkish.
Oh, dear. I don't think you told your parents that, though.
They were actually aware of it. And in my father's declining years, we talked about that a little bit, and his relationship to her parents.
You know, it's interesting how someone becomes a novelist. Your dad was an ad man in New York. You started your career in advertising. And we've had, callers who always call in and wonder, how does one make the break and become a novelist, having started? You worked with words, but you found a different way to work with words and move to rural Vermont to pursue that life. How did that happen for you?
When you graduate from college, Random House doesn't say to you, you look like a young writer.
Right, exactly.
A boatload of money writing a book. But I knew I wanted to write fiction. But I got a day job in an ad agency in New York City, and I wrote every day between 5 and 7 a.m. and Monday and Tuesday nights. And I wrote my first three novels that way while employed at ad agencies in New York City and Burlington, Vermont. And I did it because I just loved to write. And to this day, unless I'm hanging around with my beautiful wife or my daughter, there's nothing in the world I love more than writing fiction.
And at what point were you able to give up the day job and do fiction full time?
So my daughter was born, I realized that, you can no longer juggle being a novelist, an ad guy, and a dad. Something has to go. And it sure as heck wasn't going to be being a dad, and it wasn't going to be being a writer. So I officially left advertising once and for all in my early 30s then.
And at that point, you had published three books?
Right. I had published three books. And I was really fortunate because as soon as I jumped off this cliff, Hallmark suddenly parachuted into my life and made a movie out of my third novel, Past the Bleachers. Not a very good book, but a really delightful made-for-TV movie.
And that started paying the bills, and the rest is history.
Yeah, that's precisely right.
Great hour, Chris. Thanks so much for being with us. Chris Bohjalian, his new book is The Night Strangers, and as he mentioned, author of many others, the New York Times bestsellers, Midwives, Secrets of Eden. And we also want to thank our friends at WBEZ in Chicago for hosting Chris today. Thanks again, Chris. Appreciate it.
Steve, thanks so much. I had a great time.
I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. She's on vacation, but she'll be back on Monday. And thank you for spending this hour with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we are on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.